You're listening to Giles Brown on TRE Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain. Agincourt is one of the most famous battles in English history, a defining part of the national myth. This groundbreaking study by Mike Livingston, author of Never Greater Slaughter, presents a new interpretation of Henry V's great victory. Delighted to say, joining me live on the line is Michael Livingston himself. Michael, good afternoon from us. Good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Giles. Thanks for having me.
Whereabouts are you, by the way? Whereabouts do we find you on the planet?
Charleston, South Carolina, on the other side of the pond.
Very nice part of the world as well. It is one of the defining battles of English history. If you asked anybody in the street to name five battles that made British English history, I think you'd say Waterloo, you'd probably say Dunkirk, because, hey, it's what the Brits do best. But Agincourt would be up there along with Crecy and Poitiers, safe to say.
Yeah, probably in the Battle of Hastings might be up there. Yeah. And my previous book was actually on the Battle of Crecy. So followed up with Agincourt. Why not? Why not?
Exactly. So let's set this in historic, because a lot of people will know Henry V probably through Shakespeare, I'd imagine, rather than anything else. This is part of the Hundred Years' War, if I'm correct.
That's correct. Yeah, the kind of so-called Hundred Years' War. It's 116 years as most people define it. The Hundred Years' War, starts off really great for the English. Battle of Crecy, 1346, awesome sauce. They do really well. Black Death hits, screws everything up. Poitiers, they do good again. And then the English start losing pretty badly. And it's in 1415 that Henry V rolls along and invades France, makes his claim, and ends up winning at Agincourt. An extraordinary victory. It really is an extraordinary victory. And it's one that really shifts the course of the Hundred Years' War for a small period of time. Then Henry V dies and everything goes to pot. Joan of Arc happens and the English lose. But from an English perspective, I think half the time folks think that they won the Hundred Years' War because they kind of stop at Agincourt, right? We were doing so great. We won't talk about the rest of it. Because they did really do awesome in 1415.
Yeah, but it's that pesky Joan of Arc, and stirring up French nationalism and getting them behind her and any movie adaptation that you want.
Joan is amazing. Joan is so incredible. I'm actually right now doing my follow-up book is going to be a history of the Hundred Years' War. I'm actually redefining the war, but the parts on Joan are just, they're too much fun to write because she's such an incredible force.
And let's set the scene, because, again, the British and French royal families are closely intertwined. There's always huge problems. And we, as an Englishman, you can just say, well, we've fought the French more than we fought any other nation through our history. We share common bloodlines, going all the way back to Norman invasions, and that's the story and a half. During the Hundred Years' War, England made huge gains into French territory. I'm thinking Calais, when I die, you will find Calais engraved on my heart, etc. And those very productive lands, basically going all the way down to the Loire, isn't it? Am I right? I think that's the edge of English expansionism, as I think we call it.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is that from the English perspective, it isn't expansionism. They got Gascony, Aquitaine, that sort of, southwest corner of France. They had rights to that through inheritance. Going back to Eleanor of Aquitaine. And so they viewed that as their land, and the French viewed it as, no, that's French land. You have hold of it through the process of homage, that it's really our land, and you're swearing to uphold by the French king to hold that land. As long as you do everything right, you're fine. The problem is the English, they don't really see it that way. Like this should be our land. So it's a weird fight in that, sort of both sides are kind of correct. No, people don't like to hear that, but I'm an American. I got no dog in this fight. Both sides, they got a point here, and that's kind of what makes it so brutal and so difficult to resolve. Because there's not an easy solution. There are solutions attempted, but they never work because nobody wants to give up the central claim that they think that land should just bloody well be theirs, period.
Now, Explain to the listeners the composition of medieval armies, because people didn't even have an idea how they operate, the whole system of how you raise an army. And luckily, thanks to Game of Thrones, a lot of us will have a better idea, perhaps, of how people were called in a feudal society, how you didn't have much option. It wasn't a citizen army. It was you're going because I'm your boss and I'm saying we're going off to bash the French.
In many respects, that can be the case. In other respects, it is sort of like we're hiring an army. Who's going to come? Who's going to join up? Agincourt is actually more of a who's going to join us, which is really fantastic because it means that we have these muster rolls where people are signing up, make your mark here. This is the agreement for how much you're going to get paid, yada, yada. We have that information. And there's been remarkable work led by Anne Curry and her students at the University of Southampton to digitize all that information and make databases of it searchable. If you're sitting at home wondering, was my ancestor on the Agincourt campaign? Like, you can search the database and find out. It's pretty incredible.
Is this literally everybody? Or is it just the, for example, we can go on to chivalry, because what happens to French chivalry? So you'd have the Sir so-and-so of Basingstoke.
Yeah, yeah.
But would you have down to yeoman number three, of the third hamlet on the left?
Yeah, you pretty much do. And that's what's incredible about it, is that it goes down to pretty granular detail. Now, there were certainly people that were on the campaign that weren't in these muster rolls for some reason or another, but it is a kind of deep dive through the army that we don't get for a lot of the campaigns. For a lot of the campaigns, like you said, we know that, Lord so-and-so was there with, maybe our sources will say 100 men. And even that's probably, kind of not really 100. They were just like spitballing 100 men. But we don't know those guys' names. For Agincourt, on the English side, we have pretty detailed roles of that, which is, again, just, it's really unusual in many respects to have this concentrated for an amazing campaign like this. I wish we had it for some of the other campaigns, but we have it for this one. And it really gives us a good sense of the numbers involved, which is incredible.
And here's the thing. It's a battle that is in the English psyche, but where exactly is Agincourt? Because you say Agincourt, everybody says, yes. But then you go, where is it? And they go, well, it's somewhere in France.
It's in northern France. So it's actually really close to Waterloo. Crécy, Agincourt, and Waterloo are like, that's a day's trip. They're all right there. And it's a beautiful part of France. It's such an extraordinary place because, between, the Somme, where the Battle of Somme is, which is also a pretty unbelievable event, right? Between the Somme and Waterloo, like on a straight line, you've got Crécy and Agincourt. So there's just a lot of history there, a lot of horrific bloodshed has happened there. It's a place I visit a lot, obviously, because of the work I do. It's a beautiful area today. It's quiet, idyllic. It was not quiet on that day, but it's beautiful now.
Okay, so battles very rarely, Gettysburg notwithstanding, they don't start skirmishes and then develop into something bigger. So how does this one develop? What's the terrain like? And do they think, right, we're gonna set ourselves here and let the French come on to us, or is it a case of we're gonna skirmish towards the French and muck them up? I'm thinking if it's cavalry, it's got to be pretty flat and wide open. So please explain to me, Michael, what the terrain is like.
Yeah, sure. The terrain, I think, is really important. One of the things that I do as a conflict analyst is talk about, the battle. A battle is its ground. And if you don't understand topography, you really can't understand the actions that are happening upon it. Especially in a pre-modern context, these guys don't have aerial drones or anything, right? They can see what they can see where they're standing. So, what happens here is that Henry V has attacked and besieged a city at the mouth of the Seine, Harfleur, finally takes it. By the time he takes it, it takes way too long. It's late in the campaign season at this point. He doesn't want to go home having just done this. And so he decides that he's going to make what's called a chevauchée, which is sort of a riding, pillaging of the landscape, raiding of the landscape, up to Calais, which is now in English hands, thanks to Edward III and Battle of Crécy and what happened after that. In 1346. So he's going to make this ride across French lands to safety and then go home. And then he'll be able to tell everybody, I rode through France. Nobody stopped me. Look at me. Unfortunately for him, the French aren't stupid. The French know exactly what he's trying to do pretty quickly and stop him from doing that. And it becomes this cat and mouse game as Henry and his force are out of food. They are in terrible condition, awful condition, and are getting chased across northern France, just trying to get away from the French who are just coming down on all sides to prevent them from getting away and put them to the sword. And ultimately, I mean, it's amazing how far Henry gets before he gets caught. And I go through the whole thing in the book about the campaign and what he's thinking, what the French are thinking, but he does ultimately get cornered. And he gets cornered near the village of Azincourt today. We know kind of as Agincourt. But if you punch in A-Z-I-N on your GPS, if you're going to drive there, he gets cornered near there. He actually spends the night before the battle at a village called Maisoncelle. We know that. That's kind of no question about that. And then the battle occurs the next morning. He takes the best position he can. I mean, he knows he's trapped. I mean, there's no, like, he doesn't have time to sort of scout around and say, oh, that's the spot I want to be in. He's trying to run and gets caught.
Now, this is interesting because all intents and purposes, it's not just him, but it's presumably the baggage train. It's the hangers on as well. They're all there as well. So it must be a pretty confusing scene. How many men does Henry have at this point, and how many men under, and who is commanding the French at this point?
So the English side, if we're looking at the muster rolls, it looks like he should have 8,000-9,000. If you look at the traditional field, this is one of the things I go through in the book, traditionally where we say this battle happened, it won't fit. We can't have what the sources say happened can't happen there. Which is the reason I kind of shift the battle a little bit, which I know is going to upset some people, on the French side and his army, Henry's army is vastly longbowmen, which is not typical. We don't want that. We don't want that. Typically you want longbowmen. They're amazing. That's what turns the fight at Belcrecy. And you want them on the wings. But you have then a center mass of infantry, and that center mass of infantry, is often men at arms, that is, you know, knights in a kind of, you know, scare quote sort of way, right? Mm-hmm. What you think of as knights, guys on horseback. But they dismount, yeah. Hold the center. And then you have these wings of archers that will pummel the enemy as they try and come in. And soften them up before they hit this infantry that's going to not budge and everybody's going to die in front. That's the idea. But he's got way more longbowmen than would be typical for a battle like this. He is not kitted out basically for this. And he makes the decision on the field, Henry does, or he gets the credit for it. Somebody else made the decision. We don't know. To take his lines and he's going to, instead of having typically you'd have kind of like a front line of fighters, a second line in reserve and a third line in reserve for that. He can't do that. He has to put them all horizontal across the field to try and make his infantry center bigger. And then actually puts longbowmen in between those groups. So you have archers on the wings and then a center that is three groups of men, dismounted men ready to take the charge with longbowmen between them. Mm. And the idea here is this is going to sort of allow him to do tactics like he's used to doing. Will he pull it off is the big question.
Well, here's the thing. If you do that and the opposition charge you on with heavy horse, yeah. A, you've got, a, you know, you've got, he's got no third, second or third line. So if they punch through, game over. Because once you get heavy horse in the middle of men at arms dismounted, slaughter completely, and they will run them out. Yeah. And the same with longbowmen. If he punches through and they get a hold of longbowmen, they haven't got a chance in hell. And right. Remember, your men at arms, they're knights, if you like to admit it. They're used to, they know what's coming. But for your average, longbowman, I mean, he's got a longbow, and that's pretty much it. I mean, he's maybe got a sidearm, like a dagger or a stabbing yeah. sword, but he's not kitted out, so he's going to be easy prey for the French. Is this what they're thinking, the French?
This is what they're thinking. Now, Henry, there's a decent chance Henry knows exactly what they're thinking. He's not an idiot. So in the days prior to the battle, he has his longbowmen create stakes, sharpened stakes that they'll put in front of them to try and prevent that cavalry charge from just, you know, mauling them. But, you know, I mean, it really is, as you say, any point of breakage on his line and it's over. You get men in your backfield, as we say in the military, that's bad at any point. You get people in the backfield and your lines are like, our sources say his lines are four deep. If your lines are four deep, and somebody gets into your backfield, especially if they're on heavy horse, you're dead. I mean, you're just going to be crushed. So it's a terribly perilous position that he is in. He, as I said, he's trapped there. He's surrounded by French. He has nowhere to go. He's done his best with this line. And I think, you know, I've moved the battle so that we can get this all to actually fit on the landscape, and get what happens to make sense. But it is an extraordinary thing that, you know, here I'm saying he's trapped and all that. That people are going, oh, he hates Henry or something like that. No, that's just the facts, man. But what he pulls off here is really incredible, what he and his men pull off, because they don't get broken through.
Is there high ground? I mean, are there archers overlooking? Can they bring
it's,
in sort of?
It's a slight high ground. The traditional field that everybody has it on, first of all, is like too narrow, and there's all kinds of problems with it. But it's flat as an ironing board.
Right.
The field where I've kind of moved it, which is south of there, about 1,000 yards. There is some landscape variation in front of them, so they have slight high ground. Not much, but you can't get much where they are. I mean, and he doesn't have a choice. I'm trapped. This is where we're going to go. You know, so he takes the best position he can, has his stakes, and then the vital question for him, the most necessary thing, is that he has to get the French to charge him, right? Because this is not an offensive unit he has.
Yeah.
These longbowmen, you can't sort of like charge out with longbowmen. This isn't like a whole bunch of Robin Hoods or something like that. Like this is, you have to be in place and they have to come at you. This is what worked at Crécy. This is what worked at Poitiers. This has got to happen. And the French kind of know that too, right? The French, like, well, we can just sit around and starve these guys out, you know, with no problem. And the French are getting stronger hour by hour. The English are only getting weaker. It looks like they've got dysentery in their ranks, in addition to the fact that they're starving. You know, they need the fight to happen now. We're going to be weaker in an hour. Mm. So Henry has to provoke the French into the fight. And there's been debate about that. I try to sort of iron that out about exactly how that happened.
How many French and what are we looking at? Because we've said that, okay, they've got a predominance, the English got a predominance of longbowmen and men at arms. What are the French? How many French and what is their composition?
Here's the fun quote. We have no idea.
Okay.
We have no idea. No, I mean, what we know is what our sources tell us, and our sources that give us numbers are generally English, and they are kind of insane. You know, we'll get things like, yeah, there were 100,000 French. Like, no, there's not. Like, not even close. My guess is, you know, we're looking at 2-1, you know, 3-1 maybe. The French have a much bigger substantial force. They have a lot of men there, theoretically, that are cavalry. In the end, it looks like the cavalry is pretty sparse compared to what we should expect. So it's mostly infantry charges that come at the English. There's an initial cavalry hit.
Yeah.
But then after that, it doesn't... we don't get the kind of multiple attacks that we should expect. And that probably would have carried the day, honestly. This is a battle the French absolutely should have won. Mm. You know, despite Henry does a fantastic, masterful job with what he's got. And in that respect, you could say Henry won, but the French lost, you know, just as equally because of decisions that they make, mostly in the fact that they sucker into the charge.
This is now. Here's the thing, because if you grew up as an English schoolboy, cast your mind back, and I know looking at me now, that must be quite a cast back, Michael. But we're basically told that, you know, that basically we had longbows that were pretty much tactical nuclear weapons on the battlefield, because the English bowmen could punch through a barn door in Montpellier basically from the side. Now and they could fire off 15 a second. So what's the actual destructive? Because the French have come across these before, as you say, at Crécy and Poitiers. So they're not green. Yeah. They know what the longbow can do. And they might go, hang on a second, Francois, we have been in this situation before. So they're not going to go, oh, well, nothing could possibly get through my armor, thunk, you know, and that's the end of that. So what precautions are they taking?
Well, they have different armor than they had at Crecy, especially the lords and stuff like that. They've now got breastplate and kit on the upper body that should help a lot with this. And in fact, the longbow is an extraordinarily powerful weapon. I've been around them, I've shot them. They are very, very powerful. The idea that they said they can't punch through plate. Obviously, if there's like a weak spot, a crack in the plate, sure, you can maybe break through, but you can't punch through plate. You can even chainmail. What people call chainmail, that's a misnomer. Chain and mail mean the same thing. So yeah. I just said mail, but for those at home, they probably know chainmail. Even chain, when it's worn and moving on the body, does a really good job of kind of preventing penetration injuries that are going to kill. But, getting hit by one of these things, even if it doesn't kill you, is a problem. And it's especially a problem with the cavalry charge because you can't armor the whole horse. And a horse that gets hit by one of these things is not a happy animal. There's no training for that. Let's shoot our horses, and get them used to this. Like, that's not a thing you can do. So the horses on the initial cavalry charge are almost all turned back. Some of the men are killed, right, by chance shots or whatever, shrapnel. It's one of the things people don't think about, that I think a lot of the deaths that you get from the arrow are shrapnel. I mean, it's just the arrow explodes when it hits plate and you get shards going everywhere. I have a picture in the book of an amazing reenactment kind of thing that was done using slow motion photography just last year. And you see, and it's Agincourt kit and an arrow that's exploded and the broken shaft has gone right through the eye slit. I mean, Whoa. It's a killing shot.
Yeah.
And we have the picture of it. It's incredible. So well done.
And also the kinetic force of being hit by one of these things.
The kinetic force is not pleasant. Is not pleasant, right? You get hit by a baseball bat, it's going to hurt. So it's tough, but it's also, there's this image, as you say, the longbowmen can shoot so quickly. They can, it's like a machine gun. Well, no, because they'll run out of bullets, as it were. They only have so many arrows. They weren't planning on this. They were supposed to just hike to Calais. So, how many shots they've each got? I don't know, 20? We don't know, but it's probably not that many, right? They probably had a couple sheaves each at this point in the affair. So, they're picking their shots. But you got thousands of longbowmen, even if they're picking their shots. That's a lot of missiles in the air. And it's enough to turn back the cavalry without question. And it's enough to do hellacious damage to the charging lines as the French start charging in.
And so also you've got the stakes as well. So those who do make it to the line aren't going to be able to ride down the...
We have reports of guys getting stuck on the stakes, right? Their horses getting stuck on the stakes, or they manage to get around them. And then the archers do, use their dirks or whatever they've got and just massacre them.
Well, yeah, because if you get pulled off your horse and you're wearing a suit of armor or mail or chain, as we want to call it, then you're pretty, and you're an English longbowman. You've got your mates around you. Guess who's coming out second?
Yeah. I mean, it's just a dog pile, right? And dude's gonna die. So it's a it's horrific. I mean, it truly is horrific. But the key thing to the whole affair is that Henry does get the French to charge him. And when they do, they get this withering arrow shot. And those who kind of get to the infantry lines after the initial cavalry charge and the French come kind of wading into the arrow storm, many of them get through, but the English lines don't break. They bend, but they do not break. Henry himself is engaged in heavy, heavy melee fighting. It is not something where he is, 100 yards back, just cheering him on. Mm. He is absolutely in the thick of this. it is very, very bloody indeed.
Now, for those who haven't studied the melee, and guess what, armchair historian, Morning Star, and all that sort of stuff, love it. The nearest you can get is if you go back to Game of Thrones reference, but the Battle of the Bastards, where they're absolutely slogging it out. Nobody knows who's going where, and it's just literally you're just pummeling the guy in front of you and hoping that nobody's going to pummel you on the side.
Yeah, I actually do think that's a pretty good example of this. I've written about this before. You know, that is one of the better, kind of medieval, quote unquote, obviously it's not medieval, but medieval-esque fights because of that chaos, because they managed to, and the suffocating press of it, yeah. Right? There's that scene there where Jon Snow kind of gasps up to try and get air because he's suffocating in the press. We know that happened. Our sources, in fact, talk about it, but the majority of the French that die basically being suffocated under the pile of men, because there's the field is muddy that they're being forced to come through. And when they kind of hit the English, they're falling, right? And the press is just coming behind them. And so bodies are just piling up. We have this image that, you know, in the, once we kind of really get into the thick of this, that the bodies of men have become islands in the mud. Whoa. Upon which living men are fighting, which is awful, yeah. To imagine, but that's what it was.
And how long does this, I mean, apart from Howie, Howie gets the French to charge, strong language, I would imagine, but
he actually provokes them by making a march forward himself. So this has been, I'm going to just come at you now. Traditionally, what everybody has is the English, the whole line, archers and all, uprooting and moving about 1,000, 1,200 yards to take a new position right in front of the French. I think that's ludicrous. That doesn't make any sense. The French would have murdered them on the way. It doesn't make any sense of anything. And it doesn't fit if you put them where they are. And it puts the English in an even better position. It's nonsense. But what he does do is his center moves forward with a big blaring of trumpets and stuff. And he is very clearly banner out, crown on his helm. I am here, and makes this kind of like little march forward. And that provokes the French to like, are you kidding? Go get him. And that's when they go and they cannot hold their water anymore and just go in.
Does he fall back then, presumably at that point when he sees them coming?
We don't know. I mean,
that's a Saracen technique.
I think that would be. I don't have the sources to back that up.
Ah, okay.
I don't really know if he kind of stays, but it's not far that he goes. It's like 20 yards, 20 paces, which is a little bit more than that. But it's not that far. He's still under kind of protection of his arrow wings, so he's still in a pretty good shot. I kind of suspect that as they got hit, he's backing up. He's allowing that initial charge to push him back. He probably does not retreat back in the face of the French charge, but he allows that kind of kinetic energy of the impact to draw him back into a line, right? So he's not, when they bend, they don't bend out of position, they bend back into position, which is perfect, and then makes it that much more arrows that these guys get hit with in the side of the head.
How long does the battle last in terms of the actual, first contact? It's because we have these like Waterloo, for example. It's an all day affair. I mean, it could have gone on for about, but for the arrival of the Prussians or the Westphalians or whatever, it could have gone on.
All day battles, of course, are very rare.
Yeah.
Most battles end pretty quickly. This one lasts a couple hours. It depends on where we kind of date the start and finish of it. But we have, three lines of the French, three major lines, and the first two go in and are slaughtered. The third decides not to go in and leaves. Had that third gone in, I'm fairly confident the French would have taken the day. I think at that point, the English were out of arrows. The English were
dead on their feet.
Were in no position to take another hit. But that third line does not go in and doesn't go in. In the main, because that third line doesn't have veteran leadership, because all the lords who kind of have experience or who are in a position to kind of take command, they all were in the first two lines because they all wanted the glory of winning this battle. And so when they get slaughtered, There's nobody to like call the shots for the third line, so the dudes just leave.
Yeah, and that is the thing, isn't it? Of Agincourt, it is the flower of French chivalry. I've heard it described as is cut down.
Yeah, we get that. It's a funny thing. We get that same description at Crécy and Poitiers. It's always the flower of French chivalry, but it is. I mean, this is, you know, the number of lords here that dies is extraordinary. But it also should be said, English don't like hearing this. This isn't all of France. I mean, it's a French army, but I'd say it's half strength. Yeah. You know, because of the fact that France is more or less in the middle of its own civil war when this happens. One of the most powerful men in all his extraordinary army that he could bring to bear, Duke of Burgundy, he's not there. And a bunch of people are staying home or not showing up. They're going to show up late. Because they don't want to really kind of show up under the king's banner or whatever. There's all kinds of garbage going on that means France is sort of fighting with one hand tied behind its back. I mean, you know, Henry beats the snot out of that force at Agincourt, which is amazing because, again, you look on paper, he should have lost this.
Yeah,
and he ends up winning. It's incredible. But yeah, he's beating up on somebody who's only one-handed here.
You see, we are told it's the entire French army, of course. And then we're at the end of campaigning season. Very important. You do campaigning basically from May until, and this is late in the season, October, and then you go back, you restock, you feed up, and then you go and do another gig because obviously then it starts raining as only it can do in that particular region. Think Passchendaele. So is that right? Oh, game over. Let's get out of Dodge, basically, for Henry V.
Yeah, as soon as he's won, he's like, let's get going and move as fast as we can, right? You know, it's a very different image than people have of, you know, yay, hurrah, we won, everything's ours. He's like, my God, we won. Let's get the hell to Calais. Like we need to, Lord knows when the rest of France is going to show up. We got to move.
Yeah, I like that one. So redefining the battle or re-examining the battle, Michael, why did you say it's important? Because there's too many myths and obviously, you know, Will Shakespeare had a couple of nice lines in there, and then it is ingrained in the English, you know, the bowmen of Agincourt and that whole thing with our two fingers being cut off, and that's where that particular sign comes from.
Yeah, it's not where it comes from. The whole thing's full of myths. But I don't go into a project to myth bust. I go into a project because I think there's something interesting going on. I didn't intend to write a book on Agincourt. I was writing on Crécy, which was a battle that, you know, the traditional story did not make sense. It didn't add up. I was looking at the sources. They said it happened somewhere that's not where everybody said it was. Something's wrong here. And I'm writing that book, and Tim Sutherland, who's an absolutely extraordinary conflict archaeologist, he's been doing incredible work on Waterloo, but he does medieval. He is a force of nature. He's amazing. Tim Sutherland had run surveys and done major digs on the traditional field of Agincourt, and you know, he'd said, "Look, there's literally no evidence the Battle of Agincourt ever happened. There should be so many artifacts of this thing, but there's zero." And that is weird. And so he had suggested that maybe the battle was in the wrong spot. He'd made a couple of suggestions of alternative locations. And it seemed like nobody was like taking him up on it. Like, you know, why is nobody looking at all this information again? You know, because here we have archaeologists on the ground saying, you know, God, maybe it's somewhere else, y'all. But nobody was trying to put it together to see where it could be. And I was like, well, I've closed the case on Crécy. Well, let me look at Agincourt.
Yeah.
But I didn't intend in that the battle would move. It was just like, let's see, you know, like, let's check. If it ends up being where everybody says, then that's where it is. And we have to figure out some way to explain the lack of artifacts. But instead, looking at the sources and everything, it was like, no, it's in the wrong spot. That's the problem.
What do you hope that people take from Agincourt? I mean, it's still a pretty incredible military situation. So is it getting an understanding and getting away from that whole, you know, we band of brothers, we few, we marry few, etc.?
Don't get away from that. That's one of the best speeches in history. I love that thing. It's nonsense as history, but God, I love it. It's so good. So freaking good. I teach it to my cadets. When you're out on the field, you got to give a speech to the men. Here's the one you give.
Yeah.
It's so good. But you know, what I want people to take away, at least from my book, is that how history is made, and what history is, kind of definitionally, is sort of not what you think, right? I think so many people think of history as kind of written in stone. Look, we cannot change the past. That's done. But our understanding of it is absolutely contingent on what we know, about the facts on the ground, about everything else surrounding it. People will get mad, you're changing history, you're revising history. No, that's what history is a constantly evolving story about the past. And what I try to do in the book, and I've tried to do in my previous books, Never Greater Slaughter, you mentioned, and the Battle of Crecy, Battle of Five Kings, is to, when I'm telling this story of what happened, I'm telling the story of why I think that's why what happened, right? Being as transparent, showing all my work, right? Here's the evidence. Here's what I'm making of it, but here's the evidence. So that you understand, this is not, I'm not coming in just trying to, kick you.
Diss the English. Exactly.
Yeah. I got no dog in this fight. Like I said, it's just, here's the facts as I figure them. Here's the story I make of them.
As you can probably tell, listeners, I could talk to Michael about this until probably about Wednesday next week, but unfortunately, time is going to beat us. The book is called Agincourt. It's by Dr. Michael Livingston. If people want to find you online, where do they go to find more about this and Crecy and other great battles?
MichaelLivingston.com.
The book is called Agincourt. It's written by Dr. Michael Livingston. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.